Well, we haven't a minute yet, but I can get started with some announcements. I actually had to add another talk because we have another speaker coming on March 28th. That's the Wednesday after spring break. GE Healthcare is providing a speaker to talk about advances in MRI research. And since I'm not paying for anything on that talk, I said it. It was just GE interested in someone who had an idea to give a talk. We said, sure, we had an opening on March 28th after. Our next speaker is scheduled for March 14th on metamaterials from University of Texas, Gennady Shvets. He may or may not be coming. He had a death in the family and is running back to Moscow. So it's not clear if he's going to be in town or not. So I'll keep you posted, but and I'll send out an email in the event that we do have to cancel it. Today's speaker in our continuing series of physics talks is our Watkins visiting professor. Yesterday, Kathy Levin gave a wonderful talk to the public about the origins of the superconducting research and built the timeline up through high-temperature superconductors. Today, her talk is going to be what do ultra-cold Fermi gases or superfluids tell us about the quark-gluon plasma and condensed matter.
Everybody will ask questions and discuss. I've tried to make this a pedagogical lecture, and it seems to cover a formidable amount of material from ITC, which I probably will just give a tiny bit of. Quark gluon, just to give you the flavor of why these quark gluons, scientists are interested at all in atomic Fermi gases. But I wanted to be pedagogical in the sense of teaching a little bit of superconductivity, because I think if you're not using it, you may have lost it. So I'll remind you of things that may one time have been part of your coursework and so on. So it's an ambitious program. This seems to be the icon for quark gluon plasmas. I don't know how it's been the accepted icon. This is sort of an icon for the Fermi gases, and I'll tell you what each of the little little piles mean. But they attract atoms in different magnetic fields. When you see a trap with the atoms all piled up at once, that means it's in a condensate, in the superfluid condensate. And this icon is supposed to represent copper-oxygen planes with various alkaline interstitials and the high TC structure. And I've had over the years a really good group of students and been lucky to collaborate with two big experimental groups, John Thomas at Duke and Debbie Jin at Gila. So this is meant to be very introductory, I'd like to tell you what has been going on in these cold gases, the Fermi gases. The Bose gases were given a Nobel Prize in 2001, I believe, received by Ketterle, by Carl Wieman and Wolfgang Ketterle, Carl Wieman and Eric Cornell. And the Fermi gases are following closely behind with all the same kinds of groundbreaking experiments, and I'll tell you about those, no Nobel as yet. Tell you what they have in common, or why the quark gluon people are so interested in these cold gases and attend mutual meetings, interestingly enough. This I called a refresher course on superconductivity, just to tell you what it is one has done in extending superconductivity in the context of these Fermi gases, how we go out of the straight BCS picture and limited kind of nature of superconductivity. And then I'll touch on a controversy which the quark gluon people have introduced to the world, and this is this perfect fluidity, and what the cold gases have to tell you about viscosity, not just in the condensate, which is always zero, but away from the condensate in the excitations. Give you two competing theories and then show you what the experiments are telling. So, as I said, this is sort of overly ambitious maybe, but just as I said last time, in yesterday's talk, lots and lots of Nobels for this field, and still coming. And so I guess I would call the last Nobel that of 2008 that went to Nambu, who understood how BCS theory may have implications for particle physics. And that's sort of the step, an intermediate step toward the Higgs boson ideas. The community of physicists, you could say, is very much impacted by superfluidity, superconductivity. Really, nuclear physics, actually the Nobel that went to Bohr and Mottleson, this is Niels Bohr's son, Age, and Mottleson and some of the collaborations from David Pines, all built on BCS theory to describe nuclei. Quark matter, we'll see, is described, dense quark matter is described in terms of something called color superconductivity. Hadronic superfluidity is conjectured to be present in neutron stars, and of course superconductivity has enormous applications to magnets and MRI and so on. So this is a subject matter that really sends its tentacles out to lots of subfields of physics. I think that's really pretty unique in that regard. Okay, so what is this tutorial on superconductivity? What do you need to know in order to understand the bare essentials of what causes superconductivity? These are cartoons of atoms, fermionic or bosonic atoms, in a trap. So they usually draw a harmonic trap. It doesn't have to be a trap at all, but that seems to be a convenient cartoon in the literature. And of course, fermions having possibly two different spins, usually two different spins, tend with Pauli principle to stay away from each other, and so they behave very differently from bosons, which would all like to go into the same state and give you the lowest energy, and they have no restriction, no Pauli principle restriction. Well, it turns out that superfluidity or superconductivity from fermions comes from the fact that you can have an attractive interaction that pairs fermions, and when these guys are paired, they act like composite bosons. And the bosonness allows through statistics, and I'll walk through that in some detail with you, call these Cooper pairs, to condense. So we overcome the Pauli principle by making bosons out of fermions. Of course, it's hard to imagine what that attractive interaction is. It's not so difficult in the cold gases because they actually, I'll show you, dial it in. But in a traditional superconductor, or even a high TC superconductor, it becomes one of the central questions of the day. What causes two fermions to want to be together despite all the repulsion that you know is Coulomb dominated? So here's what the cold gases really added, was a knob. These atomic gases added a new knob, which we don't have in nature-made materials. And the knob has to do with being able to tune how attractive the interaction is by something called the Fano-Feshbach resonance. That basically, in the cold gases, the starting attraction is just the two-body physics. It's not a many-body physics. That has to come in ultimately to superfluidity, but it's the two-body story. And the issue of Feshbach resonance is that there is in certain regimes a closed channel bound state that lies very close to an open channel onset of continuum. And they have these two different quantum states that belong to the two-body potential have different spin quantum numbers. One's singlet, one's triplet. So with a magnetic field, you can tune the splitting and you can bring this field, this bound state, right up to the continuum and hit what's called unitary scattering. It means that there's an infinite scattering length, a very special point in two-body physics. And that infinite scattering length is sort of the focus of the Fermi gases. They like very much to get into a regime where this bound state and the open channel are lined up. And they can do that with a magnetic field. So two kinds of alkalized superfluids, the Fermi superfluids, lithium-6 and potassium-40, both have Feshbach resonances. Now they're pretty well characterized, and they dial in the magnetic field. And on one side of the Feshbach resonance, the attraction is extremely strong. And what that does is it makes the pairs grab each other very strongly and make little molecules out of them. And on the other side of the Feshbach resonance, it's very weak and very loose pairs. And it's this regime that we've studied because that's the regime nature has given us for since 1911, over 100 years, almost all normal superconductors seem to be very weakly attracted, very loosely bound, and live in this regime. But nature and the atomic physics is sort of allowing us to fool Mother Nature. We don't need a material presented to us with a particular attraction. We dial it in a contained gas. And that's the excitement of these materials, because there's a parameter that you can tune that you couldn't possibly have a counterpart for in real nature-made materials. So this picture of strong and weak attraction, everybody likes to put it in dance choreography picture, but maybe that helps. So in this BEC regime, which is actually the low field, on the low side of the Feshmach resonance, the pairs are very tightly coupled to their partner, and they're really molecular, like Cooper bosons, Cooper pairs. And on the BCS side, you have a hard time knowing whose partner is whose. They're sort of swapping all the time, and they're very weakly bound. Of course, this means a low, relatively low TC, and anything with a high TC on the scale of Fermi energy and other fermionic energy scales would be quite naturally associated with a strong glue, strong attraction. So does that make some sense then, that BCS to BEC or BCS to BEC is just a matter of dialing in a magnetic field, strong and weak attraction, and you can just characterize it by the two-body scattering length as a function of magnetic field. It'll diverge at that unitary point and be BEC small pairs or BCS large pairs on either side. So here's some points about coal gases, just a couple of key points. So we have among the alkalis just two fermionic isotopes. It's kind of interesting that there are only two, potassium-40 and lithium-6. So all the experiments in the field are done with one or the other. Few groups are now doing both. These gases are quite dilute, 10 to the 13th atoms per centimeter cubed. They can contain up to 10 to the 6 atoms. That's pretty impressive, because a numerical simulation doesn't get you up to a million atoms. So these are really fairly close to thermodynamic limit systems. Fermi temperature is on the order, this should be micro K, of the order of mu K. And the temperatures in which we can get down to now are 10 to 100 nano K. And the experiments aren't really free to go from the extreme BCS to the extreme BEC. They kind of get locked around unitary. On either side, there are decay processes and things that destabilize. So for whatever perverse reason, we're pretty locked into magnetic fields rather close to the unitary regime. But these superfluids, when you make them, live very much longer than the Bose superfluids. They're quite stable. In some sense, people say it's the stability comes from the Pauli principle, which you've sort of managed to trick by making these bosons, but at the same time, the Pauli principle prevents a lot of collisions that would otherwise undermine the superfluid. So it came as a very happy surprise to people in this AMO field, atomic physics field, that you could make these stable for an order of a second or so, which is long on atomic physics scales. So it's very interdisciplinary. I kind of covered this before. I think each community comes with its own particular agenda, and you can see the growing communities interested in this idea of crossover. The AMO perspective is they have this new knob, and so they can tune into new states of matter, even with optical lattices, which I wasn't so much going to talk about, but they can, by crossing laser beams, create lattices that are dialed into lattice constants and lattice shapes and so on to order. Condensed matter people like me are interested in the fact that when the glue gets strong, you imagine high TC is the natural. And these could be prototypes, even though the temperature scale's way low, you could still imagine they're prototypes for high TC superconductors, because the glue we know to be strong, the TC is high, and so we may learn something about cuprates. In addition to which, the BCS theory, which is the theory I talked about and will again repeat a little today, is probably the most complete theory we have in condensed matter. It's the most inclusive, predictive, universal, whatever, and it's really a special case. And all these years since 1911, we've not really been exposed, except possibly using the high TC. We haven't really met the most robust form of superfluid, which would be this BCS-BEC type superfluid, superconductor. Nuclear physics people aren't so interested in superfluidity. They like to get in the unitary regime, just see infinite scattering length, the interesting physics associated with that. And joining in on the ranks now is a whole new community that's stirring things up, no question. People who do string theory and use this anti-Disitor space, conformal field theory conjecture, have been studying aspects of the cold gases to understand perfect fluidity and low viscosity. So all, again, it's a kind of unusual opportunity for physics to really reunite. We tend to be separated in our special disciplines, but not in in this field. Now, I'm not an expert in dense quark matter, so I'd be happy to have any input, Nick, if you want to get in on this. But I'll tell you why people in dense quark matter, the slides they show and the story they tell, and why they're interested in the cold gases. You might say, well, this seems so improbable that you could connect a system which is operating at 10 to the 12th Kelvin with a cold atomic system that's operating on the scale of nanokelvin, so 21 decades of temperature. Why in the world would these guys be at all interested in learning anything about the atomic gases? So, and there's a very nice article in Physics Today about a year or so ago telling the story of how the quark gluon people have been following and gotten involved with the atomic physics. So if you wanted to read a Physics Today level set of arguments for what excites them, this is a simple way to get a quick overview. In order to look at what the quark gluon people look at, you almost have to see the phase diagram in the atomic case, and then we'll look at the quark gluon level. What you see is a transition temperature as a function of magnetic field, with this arrow being this unitary point. And if you have a very high field, it turns out very weak attraction, then TC is extremely small, which you would imagine. And as you crank the field up toward unitarity, it hits a little, this isn't an experiment, this is theory, but it probably hits a little feature there. It's hard to tell from the experiment. And then levels off to be the BEC of an ideal gas. So at very high fields, at very low fields, you just hit an asymptote, which is ideal gas Bose-Einstein condensation. And that's the phase diagram. And that's the platform for looking at what the quark gluon guys do. This is from Gordon Bame's talks in collaboration with this Japanese guy, Hatsuda. So the picture of why quark gluon plasmas may have anything to do with BCS, BEC, is meant to be plotted here. Temperature on vertical axis, like we saw before. Instead of magnetic field, now they're tuning the density. So this is, or the chemical potential, I should say. So in the BEC, the chemical potential is small or even negative. In the BCS, it gets into a positive regime, fermionic regime. They have this conjecture that in the BEC regime, which is where the chemical potential is low, the quarks are all bound into hadrons, hadronic matter, neutrons and protons. But they'll put a question mark here, so I assume that's still provisional. But that as you change this chemical potential, you break up the quarks. So this is a little different from the cold gases, into diquarks instead of triquark material. They're diquarks, which are then described by BCS paired material, or what's called color superconductivity. There seems to be a kind of strong, not necessarily smooth crossover, but actually a line that may separate the BCS, BEC. As you raise the temperature, the plasma occurs when the temperature is high enough so you don't have a superfluid and you don't even have this sort of quasi-bound pairs, which sometimes are called pseudogap. You just have a whole plasma of quarks and gluons, and that may or may not have been seen in Rick experiments. Those experiments are aimed at studying where all the quarks are pulled apart and as if there were a very high temperature phase over and above the superfluid. That all right? Anything to add there? So this community has been really excited about about solving the problems of the AMO material. And they have their predictions, and I'm going to go through what is, I think, the most controversial prediction shortly, but and then we'll look at the experiments and see who's right. I'm competing with the cork glue line guys, a different prediction. And naturally, I'm right, I'm going to be telling you this story. Or at least I'm in agreement with the experiment. So here's a overview of what's been done in the ultra-cold Fermi gases almost from the very beginning. There were a few stages before the real discovery phase, and that early stage development I did put into the history here, but first stage was to cool the gas down to the point where you actually had Fermi degeneracy, and Debbie Ginn at Jilla was the first to do that. You got cold enough, and there's no question you saw Fermi pressure, you saw Fermi statistics. The next stage was to implement this Feshbach resonance so you could actually tune attraction to be strong and weak and verify that you really could get into a strong attraction near unitary regime. And that was done first by John Thomas at Duke. And then the next stage after that was to get cold enough to get superfluidity. But the questions that come up, if you know anything about the AMO experimental world, and I really don't, but I'm always impressed when I go to the labs to see the mess on the tabletop and the mixture of lasers and mirrors and so on, that it's clear the material that's being studied here is nothing like a condensed matter material. It's probably like doing condensed matter physics with your hands tied behind your back, because there's no way to put a temperature thermometer in this stuff. So how do you know what temperature you're operating at? You can't put leads on it, so how do you know what the pairing gap is, which is something we measure with leads and IV characteristics and a superconductor. And you can't put connectors either to measure how something is transported, like thermal conductivity or viscosity. So how do you get around all the hindrances of working in this particular class of experiments and prove, characterize a system and prove that you can have a superfluid? So these are some of the questions, and I really take my hat off to these people who are very heroic for having made so much progress since about 2003 in their establishment of what these Fermi gases are all about. So Debbie Ginn early 2004 sent in a paper, FISRUB letter, none of this gamesmanship or anything. She sent in a paper claiming that she had seen superfluidity for the first time in the Fermi gas. And the way she proved that she had superfluidity is very indirect and not entirely satisfying, but people pretty much accept that first generation of evidence. Here are profiles of atoms. They're just basically telling you in real space where atoms sit in this harmonic trap. And this is in the BCS regime where polystatistics are very dominant and everything's spread out. But it still could be a superfluid. Depends on how cold it is, but it'd have to be very cold. This is in the unitary regime, where it's starting to get a little bosonized, so things start to collect toward the middle. Polyprincipal is not as operative. And this is in the BEC, where you've actually crossed over to it's a positive scattering length. And the way you can see superfluidity at this level is to do a sweep, to think about the magnetic field is swept. There's a field here that corresponds to unitary gas, and you sweep the field quickly and go into a BEC regime, which is a lower field. And if you see the signatures of condensation after projecting like this to a BEC, then you can argue, or she argued, and others seem to agree, that you probably had a condensate in the unitary regime. And how do you know what the signatures of condensation are? They're this large central peak where all the atoms cluster to the center of the trap that basically is a condensate, all atoms living in the same state. In addition to that, you see little wings of non-condensed atoms off on the side. So you use these non-condensed atoms to measure temperature because they're more of a thermal cloud. And then you use the existence of this central peak to say there's condensate. So her first generation evidence in 2004 was you can't see that condensate living in this intermediate unitary regime, but you can sweep to a lower field value, and it seems to pop up as a central peak. And so she mapped out a phase diagram. And Ketterly at MIT also followed suit, and a number of people did. I don't think this was absolutely knock your socks off proof of superfluidity, though nobody, I believe, did at that time. So the next generation experiments, I actually am a co-author in some of this with John Thomas, was to see if you could see thermodynamic evidence for a phase transition. That's closer to Jim Ho's idea that it maybe proving superfluidity simply in the thermodynamics by seeing some kind of specific heat feature. And so John Thomas, this is actually raw data, energy is a function of temperature, they needed the theory to get temperature scale through entropic conservation and so on. But it clearly showed a unitarity, some kind of a change, a slope, which was a signature of a phase transition, which would be suggestive, but again, not conclusive proof that you had superfluidity. And if it was in a BCS regime, there was no change in slope. So although that's not as convincing in this picture, but it's the BCS regime doesn't show any evidence for a specific heat jump. So we were feeling pretty good. I was excited because my work was associated with this paper that I thought was kind of a more conclusive bit of evidence in the previous generation. But we didn't get to bask in any glory at all because within a month or two, the MIT group had done something really spectacular to prove superfluidity. They utilized what's called the laser spoon and turned these atomic gases, rotated them. It's like putting in a magnetic field in a charge system. They rotated them quickly, and they saw vortex patterns and quantized vortices. And these are pictures from the MIT paper, which is a beautiful paper, showing that actually not only have vortices, you can have some kind of hexagonal lattice associated with them. Again, the vortices are visible after a sweep. So every time you live in the unitary regime, you can't quite go in situ and say you have a superfluid, but you do a sweep, and in the BEC, the atoms are repelled from the vortex center because it's normal. And you get a nice contrast image. And so, I mean, these pictures are considered some of the highlights of the field. That's sort of a smoking gun for superfluidity. So we got through first generation, and we now believe we have superfluidity. And then people said, well, what can we do to measure how paired these atoms are? What's the pairing gap? And so on. And very clever experiments came out that are very close to photoemission. I don't know how much time to spend on that. Does anybody know much about photoemission? Photoemission we use in solid-state physics all the time to measure dispersion of electrons in metals. So we take a photon, send it in, and pop out an electron and measure its momentum and its energy, and with conservation laws work backwards to figure out what the dispersion was of that electron in the metal itself. And so photoemission was developed in the coal gases in a complete analog fashion using almost the same principle, two hyperfine atomic states in which you shoot enough energy to excite one of the atoms up to a third level, and then you turn the trap off and you measure the momentum of that third state and work backwards. And so Debbie Jin did some very beautiful experiments that made very nice measurements that showed. What did they show? Well, if it took a lot of energy to kick 2 up to level 3, then it meant that 2 was bound to 1. So there's some binding, some pairing. And if it didn't take anything but an atomic energy to kick 2 up to 3, it meant 1 and 2 weren't talking to each other. So they indirectly inferred the pairing gap in a clever set of experiments. Does that make some sense? So what I want to talk about was get into the third generation experiments, which were discussed, as I said, in Physics Today a year and a half ago, which is now getting to transport. How do you do transport measurements in these materials? And point out what string theorists have been predicting and sticking really pretty strongly to their guns, that this is being observed also in the Rick experiments, is that the viscosity, shear viscosity, which is a kind of measure, it's like conductivity for a neutral system, the viscosity is bounded from below. It can't get too low, and that's been proved by this ADS conjecture. At the same time, when you go to the viscosity and you say it has to be higher than a certain bound, this is the entropy, 8 over S is a dimensionless, except for fundamental causes, dimensionless quantity. This bound here that the string theorists have inserted is definitely one of the rare occasions where string theory and experiment, i.e. Rick experiments, agree. You also have experiments telling you that the low temperature viscosity can be measured in these cold gases, and so you could do this study and see how accurate the string theory ideas are. So transport I'll tell you about in a moment, but it brings in very strong predictions from string theory, and as I say, one of the rare successes of string theory where they claim to have predicted something in Rick experiments. These are the heavy ion collision experiments. Okay. Anybody want to say something to sort of wake everybody up? I feel like I'm talking. Shall I do a little theory? You want a little BCS theory? You want to? It could be considered a refresher course because it's not very hard to understand if you've done a stat med course once upon a time. That BCS theory and Bose-Einstein condensation start to look kind of similar. And ideal gas Bose-Einstein condensation is not hard to remember from undergraduate days. The trouble with bosons is this darn minus sign in the Bose-Einstein factor, occupation factor. And because of this minus sign, when you try to satisfy a number equation and add all these bosons up, you see that you can't satisfy the number equation at low temperatures without putting in artificially a huge number of atoms in the cubical zero state. So you're never going to satisfy this number equation. That's what we're told to do in thermodynamics, unless one, you set the chemical potential to be zero at low enough temperature, which makes this quite singular at Q equals zero. And two, to handle the singularity at Q equals zero, you just prescribe that there's some macroscopic numbers of atoms living at Q equals zero, and then what's left you can count up properly. So you infer a condensate by the fact that you can't satisfy the number equation if you don't have some extra atoms all piled at Q equals zero. So the statistics is just forcing on you, and it's the minus sign, and the fact that the only way to make this work is to make the chemical potential zero and make it most harmless. And then Q equals zero has to be handled as a special singularity. So BEC is kind of just statistics of bosons. And that made some sense. Why would what other ground state would they want except the lowest state? There's no Pauli principle stopping them, so they can just pile in, and that's what a BEC is. Now, BCS is a little bit harder to understand, but I've made this a tutorial here. Is that all right? You want to do a little overview? Okay, so in BCS is a little bit different from the Fermi gas, the Fermi C, which we all know and love. I wrote this in second quantization, but the Hamiltonian for a Fermi gas, I'll do that first, just kinetic energy. What kind of states do you have in a Fermi gas? Will you occupy at zero temperature all states with K less than KF? And if you want an excited state, it's absolutely painless. There's no gap. You just excite right off the Fermi energy. Any of these states can be pushed to unoccupied states with no energy costs. And so a Fermi C results with a kind of metallic feature that it costs no energy to create fermions and excite them. They're all just piled into this Fermi C. Now, BCS comes along and says, well, you don't just have kinetic energy. You've got some attraction. Because you've got to have this attractive interaction that's going to be the source of superfluidity. And what that attractive interaction does is it rearranges the Fermi C, not necessarily throughout, but toward the edge of it where things are mobile and there aren't any Pauli principle blocking. Rearranges the Fermi C. So instead of just stacking up all occupied states up to KF, you stack them in pairs. Here's where the bosons are coming. You say, okay, I have a certain, this is the brilliant Schrieffer wave function. It was out of his head. He wrote it down and was the source of that Nobel Prize that Bardeen Cooper and Schrieffer got, a big piece of it. You have a certain fraction of the K states which are occupied in pairs and a certain fraction which are unoccupied. And you just pair them up. You can see that's not so different from here. I have a K minus K, K minus K. I can imagine the Fermi C is mostly that, the same thing. But what happens at the very edge here is what makes the superfluid different from the Fermi C. So around in the edge where you're just at the chemical potential, then you see a big perturbation from the Fermi C. And this ground state is really a Bose-Einstein condensate because it's putting a macroscopic number of particles into a bosonic-like zero momentum, k plus minus k zero state. And the interesting thing, you might imagine, is that even if with this ground state, you can't just freely excite over the, you can't just create an excitation that costs no energy because this is all paired up. And in order to excite a Fermi, you have to ungap it. You have to put in an energy delta. So the energy spectrum for fermions, instead of just being k squared over 2m, is this interesting BCS-like dispersion that has k squared over 2m minus the Fermi energy plus delta. Delta is that extra energy to unbind the pairs that are in the condensate. Break up the fermions. Is that easy, hard, trivial? Question? Okay, so again, we get back to two kinds of pairing. You can have this very strong attraction or this very weak attraction in BCS, BEC. It's just a gentle variation between the two. And that's what is interesting in the atomic gas community. So one more technical thing, and I don't need to belabor any too much theory, but this gap that we saw, that is the excitation gap, that's always there in a superconductor. It's not a semiconducting gap. You might think, well, isn't that just like a semiconductor? You have a gap to excite particles. But this is a very different kind of gap because it stays pinned to the system even when there's a current flowing. It's the superfluidity is imperturbable. It's not like a semiconductor where this is a gap that has to do with band structure and filled states and so on. This delta is really the measure of the bosonness of the system, how bosonic it is, because it's what you have to pay to break bosons. So delta is our handle on bosons. And if you plot that handle on bosons in a BCS superconductor, it looks like this. It's a universal curve. It doesn't matter if it's tin or tantalum or niobium. It falls, it's biggest at lowest T, because the bosons are all locked up, the pairs are all locked up, and then it falls off at TC to zero. And once you get into a normal system, away from superfluidity, the pairs aren't there. And that seems very unnatural in a way, but that's BCS theory, and it actually does seem to work. That means that however the pairing is, it's not changing anything outside the superfluid phase. That seems unusual, but in fact, those are the superconductors we had in nature all these years. They fit pretty nicely this curve, and the gap goes away at TC. So that says pairing and condensation happen at once, instead of at two steps. One, it should pair, and two, it should condense. It should really separate out. The high TC systems, and now we see this exactly in the cold gas, the same thing. They show when you get out of this BCS regime, that you get pairing at a much higher temperature because the glue is stronger, and superfluidity at TC, which is a lower temperature. So high TC has been showing this for years, and almost any paper you ever pick up on high TC, you'll hear this word pseudogap, and it's consistent with the idea that you just have pairs forming at much lower temperatures condensation. And all of this is degenerate in BCS theory. It all happens at one temperature. Some of this coming across? So the coal gas guys have seen these things. There's been a whole flurry of Nature papers. We've been predicting these, that they had to see them, and indeed they have. I think I'll skip this slide. In the last 2 years, lots of excitement over these pseudogap physics, because the biggest question in ITC is, what is this term, pseudogap? Now I'm going to turn back to the coal gas world, brick physics world, with my contentious issue of viscosity. And in order to understand viscosity in a in a superfluid or normal or above TC or below, you have to know what you have in your system, what you have in your gas, if you want your doer. So if you, this is meant to be cartoons, but this is typical of BCS, BEC-like behavior. So high temperatures, there's no binding. Your delta is so tiny, and there's nothing binding. Temperature is big, just Fermi-like, normal Fermi liquid. Then you start to lower the temperature, and little by little, these pairs start to find partners, and they'll glue together. Not very strongly at first, but weakly glue together, and that's these red blobs. Imagine they're changing partners, and there's a kind of thermal equilibrium between pairs, and fermions are going in and out. But these pairs are starting to form, only out of BCS. It's straight BCS, you'll never see this. Then you go below TC, and some of these pairs have condensed, and I drew that in blue. They go to zero momentum states. These other guys have some finite momentum. They're zipping around. But some of them start to condense. And then you go down to the ground state, and everything's condensed. So these are the excitations. And if you want to know something about the viscosity of a gas in the BCS-BEC system, and you think that has something to do with Rick physics, then you better darn well have in your mind the nature of the excitations that you believe are in the system. And BCS would say you have these guys above TC and these guys at any T below, and you never have any metastable pairs. So we took on the challenge then of looking at perfect fluidity in these systems, because that was the big argument of the Rick physics community. So if we're going to understand things about viscosity, shear viscosity actually, we need to know what the excitations are, because the condensate doesn't have any viscosity. So whatever you're measuring the stuff out of condensate. Condensate's zero. In a superconductor, the condensate is infinite conductivity, but again, the stuff out of condensate is what you really measure. You measure the condensate, measure the excitation spectrum there. A little above the zero frequency, if you want. So condensate doesn't do anything to viscosity, so whatever you're measuring in Rick experiments is the excitations of a condensate. We just sort of showed our pictures of that. So here comes the predictions from the cork, gluon, plasma people, and they say, here's what it's going to look like. Here's what the viscosity is going to look like. This is viscosity plotted over entropy, but it's also the same figure, really almost the same figure they plotted for the viscosity itself. So it will come on down as you go down toward TC is about here, and then right below TC will turn back up. And that's the prediction from the quark, from QCD, quantum chromodynamics, for the behavior of viscosity in both QCD, quark gluon plasmas, and their predictions for the cold gases. And here's our prediction. This is just the viscosity, and we're going to say no. What happens instead of this turnaround is you just run out of excitations, and you have nothing left in the ground state, and the shear viscosity should go away. If you go look at helium fluids to sort of get a little bit of insight, you can see the same two predictions coming out. The people who study the bosonic fluid, which is helium-4, show just what the quark gluon plasma guys are seeing, that is this upturn in viscosity. Turns out there's some phononic-like excitations at low temperatures. And the people studying the fermionic superfluid show the viscosity goes away, nothing there. It goes away because you've just gapped out all the fermions. There's no normal material to carry the viscosity. So you could say the quark gluon plasma people have decided that the cold gases should look like helium-4, in our group, using more condensed matter approaches, have decided it should look like helium-3. It is a fermionic superfluid, so you might give the edge to helium-3, or if that makes sense, you might imagine it's behaving more like a fermion than a boson. But the controversy is there. As I say, it's been written up in physics today. So which one is right? Well, you've got to go to an experiment that measures the viscosity outside of the Rick complicated interpretation. So the experiments were done by John Thomas, and the way he measures viscosity is again, not direct, because you can't put leads on this gas. So he sets up a mode, it's called the breathing mode, in the chamber of the Fermi gas, and sets it in motion, and he watches it damp. And from the damping and the hydrodynamic equations, he infers viscosity. And so questions, what did he see? And the answer is that the experiments show that the viscosity comes on down, lower, 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 and just keeps going, like helium 3. Same with even the viscosity over entropy. It doesn't have the upturn predicted by Rick people, Portland and plasma people. So far, unless something changes and this thing turns up at the penultimate moment, it looks like the condensed matter approach is a little more profitable than Quark-Gluon plasmas and quantum chromodynamics for understanding cold Fermi gases. You might say that would seem like cold Fermi gases may not relate to Quark-Gluon plasmas, but a lot of people think they do. Okay, so I'm going to close now with the sort of just the overview of what's been going on in cold gases and tell you, well, we talked about perfect fluidity and we talked, the analog of perfect fluidity is interesting, it's called bad metal. The high TC people recognize that the very low conductivity is bad, they would call it a bad metal, but the people in the AMO world, atomic world, like to think of no viscosity as perfect. So this name, I think, comes from Steve Weinberg. But anyway, it's the same. It's rather the same phenomenon. It's a dissipation under flow of charged or neutral systems. This bears on Rick physics, on ITC cuprates, and the bad metallicity I didn't really talk about. All these experimental probes that are so powerful and have been developed so quickly are really spectacular. I have hero worship for those experimenters who were able to do so much with very difficult sets of experiments. Here, let me just conclude with the fact that, for me, it was very exciting because I think of BCS theory as the theory par excellence of condensed matter and really is a special case, so it's great fun to think about. All of us have a chance to sort of rewrite every textbook because it has to be redone. BCS was just this extremely weak glue problem, and now with a strong attraction, you can tune in the cold gases and maybe is present in the high TC cuprates, you have a chance to study the much more general theory than this beautiful Nobel work. For sure, BCS-BEC can be applied to the ultra-cold Fermi gases. So even if in the end it's not relevant to cuprates, it's certainly going to be it has a real-world application. And I must say, in high TC world, there are hundreds of theories, all of them very competitive. And we did choose one that actually has a reality. Even if it doesn't apply to the cuprates for sure, there's still a place where we can see it just dead on. And so that was fortuitous because a lot of other theories are just packed away now and failed. And as I say, hopefully it's relevant to high TC superconductors and people in the Quark-Gluon world think it's relevant. And we will continue to argue, I'm sure, over what's really going on in the viscosity. And this approach, as I've tried to indicate, allows us to address these paradoxes in a fairly concrete, I hope intuitively obvious way. I'll let you guys talk for a while, ask questions.
There's time for discussions and questions.
Jim, so your approach, the mechanism for attractive mechanism doesn't enter.
No, it's just this Feshbach, these atomic guys here, and BCS theory for that matter too, let me show you. They have a two body, they have lithium 6, they can calculate to so many decimals, the shape of the potential between two lithium 6 atoms and then, as I say, they can tune the potential slightly by magnetic fielding. So you don't know what the glue is. You could say you threw the one of the most important questions out. What in the world is gluing these, at least in high TC, what's gluing these fermions together? Here we know. It's just put in by hand. In high TC, we do not know what the glue is. In normal superconductors, we do. It's some phononic. It's a kind of retarded inner attraction through phonons. It's as if one electron is attracted to the wake of another electron, the wake being created by the phonon, positive charge that got attracted, and then the other got moved away and So they saw each other in a time displaced sense. They don't like each other in real time. They like one guy to get away, and then the other guy will come there before the lattice is switched back. So it's, we know phonons in normal superconductors, and high TC is a huge mystery. It's most, quite definitely not phonons. Did I talk before you finished the question?
Yeah, I was thinking that ECS, the major contribution by ECS was the fact they identified the electrophonal interaction.
That was Frohlich, and other people had that, and Bardeen earlier.
Yeah.
That was already in place. They had an isotope measurement that said TC squared, like the scale, like one on the square of the isotope mass, which meant ions. I mean, it was just a beautiful smoking gun. So that BCS paper is not credited with the electron phonon mechanism. At that point, they'd already had that. But Bardeen knew it. And everybody thought in high TC, well, we'll figure out this mechanism. It surely shouldn't be that hard. But it's still, we're 20-some years into it, and it's not answered yet. And so we've decided it's a question we don't want to answer. We'll just go on and answer other questions. And what people really, really like these days, I don't know if you went to any talks at the March meeting on high TC. There aren't that many. They're getting slowly damped out. But it's pseudogap. This idea that something is happening in the normal phase that looks like a gap before superfluidity.
What was the lowest temperature for Thomas' experiment?
John Thomas?
Yeah.
I think down to about 0.05 of the Fermi energy, 0.05, 1/20th of the Fermi energy. The Fermi energy is micro K. So, let's see, I could go down to that slide, but it's true. It's still possible that this thing could turn around.
But
everybody who's studied helium-3, and that's been done by many groups since the mid-70s, not seen it come back up. But it's important because it says either you have no more excitations, which makes perfect sense in a Fermi superfluid, they're just gapped out and you lose them, or you have some other incomplete condensate or some phonons or something around. So it's at the heart of what microscopic theory you need. And I think settling that debate, it will be very important.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments, discussions, Tom?
Just interested in the analogy with QCD and nothing you said, people try to compute these quark gluon plasmas with lattice QCD. Did you contradict that in some way?
Well, I think I did. I don't know if I brought all my slides, but do you know, Thomas Schaefer? He does QCD.
I'm not an expert.
Okay. So. They predicted, probably need to go, let's see. Okay, so this is the viscosity slide. Let's see if I have, I don't have anything from Schaefer here, but they predicted that it would look like, this is a figure out of the QCD calculations. For some reason, the quark gluon plasma looks just like that. I should have kept that slide. I didn't have it with me now, but the unitary gas and the lattice QCD predictions, I guess because of the infinite scattering length and so on, they argue that they're going to be mapped one into another. They seem to be in two parts, and I don't understand the two curves exactly.
But this is a calculation?
This is a calculation from QCD for both the quark gluon plasma, which I should have brought you, but it looks exactly like this, and their prediction that John Thomas should see this in the unitary gas.
Well, what do they see at Rick?
And at Rick, they see, well, I don't know if they see the turnaround. I guess what they're really thrilled about is they see the bound. The bound is also important, that it doesn't exceed, there's this lower bound that ADSC of T has, that it rises above the bound. And part of that is part of the perfect fluidity. But I think also I'm not absolutely sure, but I think the QCD stuff isn't so inaccurate. And it does do, that's more like helium-4. I mean, it's remarkable that these two superfluids with slightly, totally different statistics, but their behavior, their excitations in the ground state, or near the ground state, are very different. So helium-4 and helium-3, which is, you know, they're really different beasts, even though they're both superfluids. There's just a lot of stuff left over in helium-4 that doesn't condense, and phonons as well, and so it pulls it up. And I think that's very much in the theory and spirit of the QCD calculations, that they're phonon-like excitations. I'm not sure what they're mapped onto in QCD, but phonon-like sound modes of some kind or something. Whereas helium-3, it says you just have fermionic excitations, no pairs or anything, and they go away because there's a gap. You can't excite them low T.
Do your results then kind of somehow suggest that maybe there needs to be some revision of QCD, or just we don't know how to calculate that?
I'm not sure yet. I think this time will tell, but it's quite possible. A lot of these conjectures are built on, a lot of these results are built on conjectures, the connections and so on. It's a pretty complicated story because the phonons aren't allowed to enter in here. We do have phonons. We have Goldstone bosons that Nambu and Anderson and so on, the soft mode that for the gauge symmetry restoring. But they can't couple to a probe like transverse. They're longitudinal. So what the QCD people have been doing is something that's not kosher to a fermionic superfluid. You're not supposed to put the phonons into a transverse mode. You basically violate gauge invariance. And that's, you shouldn't do it. We know not to do it. We get some rule correction, everything correct, as long as we don't put those extra gauge bosons in. And the Schaefer crowd, maybe because the problem is somewhat different, is putting the phonons in. We don't know. I mean, the only way you know whether you've really done it right, aside from experiment, is some rules in study, which are really conservation laws being checked. And so we checked, and they have not. They don't seem to care about some rules in the same passionate way that condensed matter people do, maybe because they have more faith their diagrams are okay. We never know if our diagrams are okay, but we do know if it satisfies a sum rule, it's passed an important check. I don't know how it'll play out. I mean, most people think, well, BCS-BEC has to be continuous, doesn't it? So why wouldn't it just have to turn up somewhere in all of these? Why shouldn't you get back that upturn? And maybe what it is that the BEC that you get out of a Fermi gas isn't an interactive BEC. It's a very special BCS wave function BEC. It's still very composite and has a Fermi statistics built in. So you maybe never should expect it to look like helium-4 in the Bose system. It's, if you take that wave function ansatz, it's a special fermionic version of bosons.
Other comments, discussions? You're invited to come down to the physics conference room where we have coffee and cookies. We can have further discussions. Okay, let's thank our speaker.